Happy New Year, everyone. This is episode 12 of Radio Imbibe from Imbibe Magazine. I'm Paul Clark, the executive editor of Imbibe, and this episode isn't just kicking off 2021, a year that we're all hoping will turn out to be much, much better than the year that preceded it, but it's also kicking off our annual Imbibe 75 issue. In a typical year, our Imbibe 75 list is filled with people and places and destinations and directions that we think will influence the way we all drink in the coming year. And while we love bringing you new bars and coffee shops to check out and new beers and fun cocktail recipes to try, this past year was kind of weird. We're starting 2021 not only hoping for a better state of affairs around the world, but with a greater awareness of the enormity of the challenges we've been facing and that we'll continue to face for many more years to come. The COVID crisis, the economic upheaval, political turmoil, and the lingering impacts of institutional racism all combined to make 2020 such a challenge. So to start 2021, we're steering our Imbibe 75 coverage in a different direction. We're visiting many of our favorite people in the drinks industry and hospitality world, as we always do. But this year, we wanted to focus on people who are helping to make the hospitality industry a more positive, equitable, and overall better place to work, and to feature those who are working to help others in the industry and in their communities to build a better future for us all. We're kicking things off with a chat with Jackie Summers, a Brooklyn-based distiller, entrepreneur, author, and speaker, about the work he's been doing these past few years to build a more equitable drinks industry for everyone. You know, I first encountered you almost 10 years ago when you were getting your distillery up and running and making Sorrel. And now in the past few years, you've become a fixture as a speaker on the cocktail conference circuit, things like Tales of the Cocktail, Global Cocktail Week. And back when we had in-person stuff, things like Bar Convent and Rochester Cocktail Revival. Across these events, you've led and moderated conversations along with other beverage industry professionals, largely focusing on telling the stories of marginalized people in their own voices. How did your experiences in the industry as a distiller prompt you to take this next step in sharing these stories?
You're familiar with the hero's journey, where an individual takes a call to action and adventure and sets out on a particular path. And it seems to be going well. And then at a certain point, everything goes completely off rails. And they need to go learn something that they didn't think they needed to know and become someone that they didn't think they needed to be so they can get back to where they started in the beginning but changed. That has sort of been my path with Sorrel. At this point, most folks who know of me are aware that when I got my liquor license in 2012, I was the only Black person in America to hold a license to make liquor. And you can imagine the kind of experiences that go along with that. I mean, basically, no one had ever seen a Black liquor brand owner before. But it really became a problem because the brand did well and the big liquor companies approached me. And while everybody wanted the brand, they didn't want me. And there's literally nothing more American in this country than taking the ideas and creativity and labor of a person of color, monetizing it, and then shutting them out. So I thought the best thing that I can do, not actually for myself, but for my industry, was to help educate people about the nature of marginalization. And much to my surprise, the industry is slowly but surely changing. Go figure.
One of the things I saw you mention at one point was that you launched your first product. You launched Sorrel the same year that Trayvon Martin was killed. That was the same year you started writing about racism and having these kinds of conversations with people in the industry about racism. How have those conversations and the openness to talk about this and confront it changed over that time?
I had been writing about racism for years before that as an editor for the Good Men Project, but I started to speak about it in our industry when Trayvon Martin killed because people that I was in business with suddenly came out as really racist. And the interesting thing about it back in 2012 is no one else in the industry of color that was seeing this was talking about it because everyone was legitimately and rightfully afraid of reprisal. And I will tell you that I went through tons of reprisals. I lost tons of clients. I lost tons of business. I lost a lot of money trying to draw a line in the sand about where my principles are. But at the end of the day, my belief is if you can't stick by what you say you believe when it's under duress, when it's under trial, you don't have beliefs. You have slogans. My integrity is everything. It's one, like, they can take a lot of things from you. You've got to give away your integrity. And it just was not something I was willing to give. I can make more money. I can't make more integrity.
One of the things, as you've been doing these conversations at these events, at events like Tales of the Cocktail, in talking with other people within the industry, you found some commonalities among the stories, some of the shared experiences that you're hearing. What are some of those things that have been coming up time after time as you've been having these conversations with others in the industry?
The interesting thing is the reluctance to pay. I've got a running joke with Tiffany Barrera out of Atlanta about people wanting to pay her in food. And it's not that I don't appreciate the gesture, but I live in Brooklyn. Like, I cannot pay my rent with food. There is a continuing issue of equal remuneration. And unless folks are willing to actually pay an equal wage, we are not having the same conversation. I'll give you a great example of this, and you'll appreciate this, Paul. When we lost Brother Ahmad, I sent out a tweet that went viral. And the tweet said something like, I wish white people would protest when a black man is killed the way they protest when they need a haircut. It got like 150,000 likes. And the editor of a media company reached out to me and said, well, this is great. We'd like for you to write a story on it. Can you tell us the top 10 things white people can do to be better allies to black people? We'll pay you 6 cents a word. Paul was laughing because 6 cents a word is less than a poverty rate. My response was, No, I cannot do what you're asking. Number one, because the first thing that white people can do to be better allies is to pay black people what they are worth. And in order for me to write an article for you for 6 cents a word, the entirety of the article would be, Google how to be less racist, keep the change. I said to them, "You, every time this happens, you think it's a story and you want to an essay on it. But the truth of the matter is, the story is that you keep asking what to do and we keep telling you what to do and you keep not doing it. That's the article I'll write for you. I said to the editor, I'll write an article for you that says what you should have done when we lost Ahmaud Arbery is what you should have done when we lost Sandra Bland, and what you should have done when we lost Trayvon Martin, and what you should have done when we lost Philando Castile, and what you should have done when we lost Mike Brown, and what you should have done when we lost Trayvon Martin. The story is that you keep not listening, and I'll take my regular rate for it. Thank you. The rate at which marginalized people are financed or have access to bank loans is minute compared to what we see straight white males get. And the really interesting part about it is if you are the straight white male and you get the money and your business fails, the response is always to get more money because you didn't have enough to be successful. There aren't really paths for redemption like that if you're a person of color and you get money and it fails. They blame it on you as opposed to all of the situations that surround that make doing business very difficult. And just the idea of access, I'll tell you right now, I'm super lucky. My mentor is a guy named Arthur Shapiro. He's the former CMO for Seagram's, and he can pick up the phone and call anybody, and they'll answer. That level of access is not something that like we have an opportunity to get to. Just being able to talk to the right people and have them take you seriously is the beginning of all good things. And it's hard to quantify exactly how much of a barrier it can be when you have the creativity, when you have the volition, when you have everything that you need, but the ability to move forward because there is no bridge and there is no pathway for someone that is marginalized.
You know, one of the analogies that keeps being used over and over in this kind of situation is talking about having a seat at the table. And that's an analogy or a metaphor, whatever you want to use, that you use a lot, I've seen in your talks, both in terms of, the whole building a longer table versus building your own table. Could you explore that just a little bit? Because I've heard you go on about this at events over the years, and it's really compelling, and I'd like to share that with people a little bit.
I gave a talk called How to Build a Longer Table for 3 or 4 years, with the idea that I could convince people who were seated at the table, and by that I mean the table of power, the table where decisions are made, to extend their tables to people who did not have access for everyone's benefit. It was not dependent on altruism. I went with statistics to show that it was actually financially irresponsible not to have a diverse group of people sitting at your table making decisions. I came with anecdotes. I came with statistics. I came with sound and fury and passion. I spoke to thousands of people. It was incredibly well received, and it didn't really change much. And I started this year out trying to rethink how I could, again, present material that would help open up access and gates and doors. And then COVID hit, and it overturned all the tables. And the first thing people asked was, how can we get back to normal? And my response was, why should we? Why should I help reset a table where I was never welcome? Why should I help reset a table that was designed to exclude me and people like me? This seems like right now has never been a better time for people to build their own tables. And by that, I don't just mean tables for themselves. I mean tables that are designed to be equitable for everyone instead of designed to include certain groups. So while build a longer table is a great slogan, I've got a James Baldwin quote stuck in my head. James Baldwin said years ago, your slogan always hides your truth. And you have to have the courage to look behind the slogan. And the truth behind the slogan, build a longer table, is no one's actually doing it. At the end of the day, we need to build our own tables. And we have examples of that. You can look at Samara Davis of Black Bourbon Society, built her own table when she didn't see herself being served. You can look at Lynette Marrero of Speed Rack, built a table when she didn't see women being served. You can look at Yannick Benjamin, Wheeling Forward, built a table when he didn't see disabled people being served. And all those tables not only welcome everyone, but actually really do well because they're focused on community. I really want to see tables built that, instead of being designed to only accommodate a particular few, are designed to accommodate everyone who can contribute and expand. I think it's a better way for all of us eventually.
This podcast episode is going out in early 2021, but right now, at the time we're having this conversation, it's still mid-autumn, and we don't know a lot of things that are going to happen between now and then. But we do know that this past year has been grueling on a number of fronts: pandemic, economic collapse, devastation of the hospitality industry, political turmoil, and our friends and colleagues in bars and restaurants are having to deal with a lot of problems right now, from loss of income to loss of business and the fraying of all of these social networks. Among the topics that you address are things like health and addiction. Coming into 2021, what are some of the challenges that these friends and colleagues of ours are going to be facing, and how can we provide the kinds of support that people need right now in order to make it to better times ahead?
One of the biggest things I still see people battling with is how they have emotionally tied their well-being to their productivity. I think it's important for people to understand that you are not your productivity. You are not your value to society based on what you can produce that has monetary value. Your value is innate. And that requires unlearning everything we would talk about how to function in capitalist society. I think that's a big part. I think we're going to have lasting emotional and mental issues around this time of upheaval that's going to require a significant change in how we approach our lives and our businesses and how they integrate. I think we've got a lot of evidence right now that says we have seen the dependence on substances rise dramatically. So we're going to have substance abuse that needs to be attended to. But I think the biggest thing is we've all had to deal with ourselves in a way that we have been able to distract ourselves from. The interesting thing about all of these shutdowns is people have had time on their hands, and they ran out of ways to distract themselves months ago. They baked sourdough bread. They learned pickling. They painted. And at the end of the day, you're still left with yourself and disquietude of your thoughts. And that's a gift. The gift of being able to sit with yourself is how we grow as human beings. So hopefully, with guidance and with the right resources, we'll see people move forward to better versions of themselves, and so the better version of our industry.
And now you've got a illustrated book on social justice that you're working on, that you're shopping around. Can you give us a little bit of a preview of what you have in mind with that?
So I wrote a parable called The Garden of Infinite Fs, F standing for the F word. And it is a student going to the teacher saying, I'm out of Fs and I don't know what to do. And the teacher tells him, you really need Fs. Because Fs show that you care, and the world needs caring more than ever. Your problem is allocation. And the teacher goes on to show him how he can allocate his Fs so that he doesn't run out, which I think will work really well as an illustrated story for adults. There are a bunch of other things in the work, but that's the big one right now, and I'm very excited to bring that to market, because just on the day that we lost Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I think I didn't see the F word used more than ever else in my entire life. It was the entirety of what people felt and thought. And the very next thing after that is people think they're out of Fs. No, you can't run out of Fs. We need you to care. We need you to care so much that you never, ever stop fighting for what will make the world a better place. But you cannot waste it on dumb nonsense. And that, I think, is really the trick, is learning how to, not just to cultivate what you care about, but how to not waste energy on things that aren't worth your time.
Well, Jackie, thank you so much. It is so good to talk to you, man. I like I was saying before we started recording, I always love running into you over the years. You know, we show up at events together. Now we're on opposite sides of the country. I got your face on camera. It's really good to see you, man. I can't wait to cross paths with you again in a safer day.
To better times. They're coming. Stay safe, Paul.
You can find out more about Jackie Summers at his website, jackiesummers.nyc. Lynn House has long been one of my favorite people to talk to in the drinks world. A longtime bartender who once helmed the drinks program at Blackbird in Chicago, Lynn is now a national brand educator at Heaven Hill Brands. But in addition to her work with Heaven Hill, Lynn's been active on multiple fronts in the drinks world, speaking and teaching on topics relating to diversity and inclusivity, as well as one of the isms that's often ignored in the hospitality world, ageism. For our Imbibe 75 coverage this year, I chatted with Lynn about her work in establishing tipping for equity with another of this year's Imbibe 75 figures, Tracy Franklin, as well as her efforts to confront ageism in hospitality and how detrimental it can be to career professionals. You know, you're a former bartender and a national spirit specialist and portfolio mixologist for Heaven Hill Brands, which is all fantastic. But the reason I wanted to chat with you for the magazine and for the podcast is because of some of the other work you've been doing the last couple of years about some other aspects in the drinks industry and in our society at large. Can we start with talking about Tipping for Equity, the nonprofit you started with Tracy? Tell us how and why you both started that project.
So this project between the two of us came about really as a reflection of what was happening this summer with all just the bandages of social injustice being pulled away. Obviously, George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and we were all home. And, you know, Tracy and I are both women of color. So this topic has always been near and dear to us, but it just got thrown into the spotlight. And it literally started out when everything was happening and with COVID, us reaching out to each other and just checking in and say, hey, how are you doing? You know, this is a hard time for a multitude of reasons and a very emotional time. And we both in those conversations were like, we want to do more. What is it that we need to do? And what can we do from the perspective of where we were? And so our first, you know, thought was together was kind of combining our super social media powers together and doing something online To create conversation, to create a vehicle for conversation. And so we bandied about that for about a month and a half. Like, we knew what we wanted to talk about. We knew what our focus was. We didn't just want to be like another organization that competed with somebody. We didn't necessarily, obviously in COVID, weren't at the capacity for hosting events, but we wanted to be a vehicle for conversation. And so that's really kind of the infancy of where that conversation started. And then we started thinking about things that were important to us. And the word tipping is really, really important to us, because I think a lot of people, while it's a controversial world right now, as people are like, do you tip? Do you not tip? You know, what is the practice? It's to understand its history. It's born out of post-slavery times as a way to have people keep from paying their employees and still have free labor.
And I think that's one aspect of the hospitality industry that a lot of people just aren't familiar with. I mean, I was unfamiliar with this story until relatively recently.
Yeah.
As you guys have implemented this and have started putting this together, you had your first event, your online event, through Tales of the Cocktail this past fall. As we get into 2021, and as we start moving to a point where will be hopefully the post-COVID world, and the hospitality industry will look at starting to rebuild from some of the devastation that we faced this past year, how do you see this unfolding? What directions do you see this organization going?
So what we're doing with the organization, first and foremost, is we're growing it slowly and responsibly. I think a lot of people wanted like look at projects and like try and cut off a big piece of cheese. And we both are professionally very busy. Tracy's embarked in a new venture, which I'm so excited about. She's going to become a master distiller for Uncle Nearest, which there's a lot of training. I have a lot of things ongoing. I'm in a newer position with Heaven Hill. So we had to realize what our own personal constraints are. And I think sometimes a conversation that we both had was that it's hard to say no. And so we've learned to say no to each other. So we're growing this slowly and responsibly. Where we see this, the first kind of step is as a social media organization, first and foremost. So it's non-profit. We're not, all our time is donated. Any resources that we go to building out sites and any kind of things that we activate, Tracy and I take on ourselves. We absorb that cost. It's been very minimal at this moment, but we want to bring in new voices and kind of shine a light onto them and give them a platform, because there's so many people as we look in this industry, the generation after me and Tracy, the generation after that, you know, I'm 55. So a lot of new people turning 21 this year who have grown up in kind of an activism mindset. And we want to give a light, shine a light on what they're doing. We want to address our pillars, which has to do with education, promotion, activization, organization, and showcase people who are already really being successful in doing that. So that's what we're doing right now. So we're building it very slowly. Our long-term plan is we would love to be full up, you know, 501(c)(3) active and hosting some regional and national and potentially global events, but we're building it so that we do it right. We don't want to rush it.
And just so we're clear about some of the goals and the mission for the organization, can you just kind of paint that picture for us of where you see the industry going, or how you would like the industry to unfold, and how you think by using this platform, we can help get there?
Something really interesting happened. We talked about Tales of the Cocktail a little bit at the beginning, and I'm a co-chair of the education committee of Tales of the Cocktail. And we're getting some of the feedback now from how it was received this year. And overwhelmingly, the seminars and presentations and roundtables that had the largest draws actually dealt with DEI, diversity, inclusion, and equity initiatives, whether it was people of color, women, you know, LGBTQ+. And so we would like to see this industry go, and where tipping for equity kind of comes from is, you know, why tipping also comes from this act of oppression, it's also a verb that means shifting the balance. And so we look at it as a means of, let's have conversation, let's have dialogue, let's present educational opportunities, let's share historic notes that maybe people don't know. You mentioned not knowing about the origins of tipping. So many people don't know the origins of tipping. And when you explain it to them, they're like, light bulbs go off, particularly for those who've been against fair wage pay for hospitality workers. You know, it's like, it's a person shouldn't have to dance to make a living. They should have to do good work to make a living. And so where we see this going and where we see the industry going is a lot of people in so many different ways are working to shift the balance to make the industry of hospitality more equitable, which makes sense because hospitality is a reflection of society. So if our bars and restaurants and hotels and all those kind of venues can reflect the way society should be in makeup and practices, it's going to build for a better society.
And that's fascinating that, that you put it that way in talking about the world of hospitality and how it both reflects, but also somehow encourages the development of the way that we deal with each other. Because another topic that you and I had discussed just really briefly by email that I wanted to dig into is something else you've been active about. In 2019, you moderated a conversation at Chicago Style about ageism in hospitality. And when I mentioned to you that I wanted to talk about this, you said this is such a taboo subject in the industry. Why do you think that is?
Because people don't talk about what they're scared about. We talk about what we think we can make change in. We talk about what we think we can do tomorrow, but we don't talk openly about what we're scared about. And the one thing that unites everybody across the board, no matter gender, ethnicity, religion, is age. We're all going to get old. We all have a lifespan. And that's a really, really difficult thing to talk about and to embrace and to recognize. And so I think out of all the isms, this is the ism that we don't talk about, where there is discrimination and prejudice and barriers put up, is ageism, because we don't want to talk about getting old, right? Everything, you know, you look at every marketing campaign for anything that deals with an older person, it's like how to have a better quality of life. This is the fountain of youth. This is this. And in our industry, this is particularly if you're a bartender, one of the reasons I left the stick, it's so physical. It's a physical industry to be in, and it became painful to continue to bartend 5 nights a week. You know, I'd spend every Sunday just with my feet up because my back hurt, my feet hurt, my shoulders hurt, everything hurt. So that's part of why I made a shift and change. So I think we just don't talk about it because it scares us, but we have to talk about it because it is a subject that is going to touch every single person, no matter what your ideology, what walk of life, everything that you come from. Ageism, particularly in an industry that's so physically challenged with what we do day in, day out, is going to be something we have to tackle.
Absolutely. And I think the hospitality industry and media is very much like this as well. They're industries where we're always looking for what's new, which typically means people that are younger, people that are pretty, things that are very attractive. We don't like looking at that flip side of life, that we all age and we all get older. And this is going to be something that we all have to deal with. You mentioned some of the physical issues, but one of the other things about ageism is it really factors into our employment and our income, because it can be harder for people in various industries to find employment as you get older, or to find promotions, or to have new opportunities come your way as you get older. What's the risk to the industry itself for continuing to treat aging workers as if they're disposable?
I mean, that's a huge risk because you're losing a huge resource, because, you know, we know with age comes wisdom and education and learning. There are so many people who have so much to offer. And, you know, I can't stand for 14 hours anymore, but I can offer a lot about how to make cocktails and such like that. One of the things I'll say that's really interesting about ageism, you know, I had my 55th birthday this year. I've been a grandparent for, oh my gosh, 14 years. My granddaughter turns 14 next week, which is crazy to me. And I remember about when she was 3 or 4 and I was just talking about hanging out with my granddaughter, I was online, you know, I'm very proud of it. And I had people reach out to me and said, you need to stop talking about your grandchild because people are going to suddenly realize how old you are. And it was really disconcerting because I'm so proud of my grandchild and love. And it did affect me because I didn't speak about her existence for about 6 months. And then I was finally like, screw that. Like, this is who I am. This is how old I am. I came into this side of the industry, the craft side of the industry, older. I was a professional actor. And so I didn't start in the craft side of the industry until I was 40. And, you know, but there's a lot to offer. There's wisdom. There is knowledge. There's a temperance of attitude and ego. And there's also just the understanding and embracing of mentorship and how important that is. And so I think one of the dangers that we have when we shut older people out of the industry is we're shutting out teachers, we're shutting out mentors, you know, and the lessons aren't just about the industry, they're life lessons and they all intertwine within each other. And I still learn from so many people who came before, you know. I have quite often regular conversations offline with Audrey Saunders. And it's for her as a woman who came up in the industry when women weren't being showcased in the craft side of the cocktail. She's got so many stories to tell and lessons to learn about how to promote yourself and temper yourself and how to like navigate a field. And so I think about that with any industry, that when you shut out people who aren't, you know, the cute 30 plus grape, you're shutting out a voice, and that voice is really important.
And when you and I first started talking about this by email, I was really kind of looking around for people who are advanced in some way as an activist on this subject. Who are leading the conversations? Who has an organization? Who has an initiative that we can follow? And the thing I kept finding was nobody. Nobody is really leading the conversation on this, which is, you know, kind of astounding in some ways, but it just kind of marks that this is a prime point to have this conversation. And it's the kind of thing that we've talked about informally. You mentioned chatting with Audrey. I know I've chatted with colleagues in the drinks industry, in the media industry, about age and our categories. Where do you see this conversation going? What do we need to be doing in the years to come? Because one of the things that we've done just in the last 15 years is made bartending, made hospitality a career, not just a job that people go through for a couple of years, then go off and do something else, but actual career. How can we help create the industry that will sustain those people in a long-term career and make them feel welcome and use them as a resource?
So I think there's a couple of things that we have to do. And I see some of it happening right now, which is so exciting to me. First and foremost is mentorship. Those of us who are more established need to make ourselves available for mentorship to kind of show people an arc, teach people the way. One of the things in this industry that is very different from the original birth of the cocktail industry in the United States was, you know, you interned and did internships for 2 years before you even got to touch the bar. And we don't have that now. Now you can kind of read a book or be in the right place, right time, know the right people, and suddenly have a very, you know, public and open job. So I think mentorship is really important because there are a lot of lessons that you can't teach in a book. So it's really important to pay it back and pay it forward. I think having these conversations is important. This is, in my entire career, only the second conversation. The first was Chicago Style, which you mentioned, where I actually talked about ageism in this industry. So we need to talk about it more and kind of just demystify the myths and take the fear around it. And as you mentioned, recognize this is a full career. You know, there's very few people who are going to bartend for 60 years. There's a handful of them. God bless their souls. I'm not one of those people, you know, because it's just too physical for me. But there's so many different arcs in this career. And so one of the things that I see is happening and something that I try to do when I'm out in the market is talk about all the career avenues that you can start behind the bar, whether it's serving, creating, running a bar. But there's a lot of new avenues that weren't open to us before. And the whole, even my job right now, you know, I'm brand ambassador, supersized, you know, with my position and title. But brand ambassadors, when I was coming up, there weren't brand ambassadors. You know, when you look at distributors, they have portfolio mixologists. When I was coming up, there weren't portfolio mixologists. You have consultants. When I was coming up, nobody was consulting or running consulting organizations as using their knowledge to talk to others. So there's a lot of avenues and those are going to continue to grow. Even in COVID life, it's shifted. We're virtual. So those opportunities have increased because we can touch more people without traveling. And so I think talking about those and really illuminating people as to the possibilities are endless of what you can do in this industry. They used to be very limited, like you were a bartender or you owned a bar and that was it. But now there's so many things that you could do. But you're absolutely right. There is great longevity in this industry. It can be a career. It can be a very fruitful career. I think it's a great career also for people. The path of college and such is not always a direct path, but being able to succeed in the hospitality industry, I think, transcends that. So,
well, between tipping for equity and working to address this issue of ageism and hospitality and getting past the COVID crisis, I think we're going to have our work cut out for us in 2021. But it's the kind of work that's kind of exciting and engaging to get into, because it is kind of creating a better world for this industry and for the people within it. Lynn, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. I really appreciate it. It's always wonderful to talk to you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Find out more about Tipping for Equity by checking out the organization on Instagram and Facebook. Follow the link in this episode's notes to get there. And that's it for this round. We'll have more Imbibe 75 coverage for you coming up in future episodes. Be sure to check out our January-February issue to learn more about Jackie and Lynn and everyone on this year's list of our Imbibe 75. Keep up with us online at imbibemagazine.com for more articles and profiles. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast and to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, and Facebook to keep up with us on the day-to-day. And if you're not already a subscriber to the magazine, here's your opportunity. Just follow the link in this episode's notes and we'll take care of you. I'm Paul Clark from Imbibe Magazine. Thanks for joining us this round, and here's hoping we all have a safe, healthy, and happy new year ahead.